Yes. So we're going to look at kind of an overview of world religions. And the eight that I picked are Buddhism, Hinduism, Mormonism, Latter-day Saints, Judaism, Islam, Jehovah's Witness, Seventh-day Adventist, which is a brand of Christianity, but different enough, I think it's worth talking about, and Unitarian Universalist. So that's eight. If we do one a week, and we're going to take a week off after Easter, because I'm not going to be here, and there's a week in May that I'm going to be away at a conference, 8 weeks should take us right about to the middle of June, which will be a good place to stop. And if we go 9 weeks or 10, that's okay too. And we can talk as we get closer to the end what we want to do in the fall.
Oh, we don't meet in the summer?
We don't meet in the summer.
Okay.
So we usually stop sometime between the mid to the end of June, and we'll pick up again when the program year starts in September.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So that's kind of the plan. It works out about one a week, which means we're not going to do a deep dive into any of these, but just kind of a surface view. But like I said, if you have questions and we end up extending it a little bit, that's okay. And we're going to start with Buddhism. So, and I'm going to talk and interrupt me when you have questions. All right? So let me start by saying, just like there are many different brands of Christianity, there are many different brands of Buddhism, and some of them you might have heard of: Tibetan Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, there's a bunch of others. So just like Christianity, you can't really say, well, all Buddhists believe this, all Buddhists do this, because just like, you know, the Lutherans handle things one way and the Catholics handle things another way. Hi, Marilyn. And the Eastern Orthodox handle things another way. The same thing is true in Buddhism. So if you ask me, what do Buddhists believe about, I'm going to say, well, it depends on which one you're talking about. And my knowledge of the minutiae of the differences is pretty thin, so I may not have an answer for you. Just warning you ahead of time.
So what are some of the different groups?
The ones you probably will have heard of is Tibetan, Zen Buddhism. There's...
Is that Japanese? Or?
Not really.
Okay.
No. There is a specifically Japanese flavor mm-hmm. of Buddhism. There's a specifically Chinese flavor of Buddhism. There's what's called Lamaic Buddhism, which focuses on not the Dalai Lama, who is Tibetan, but on other lamas. And a whole bunch more, whose names I don't even really know that much. However, there are some things we can say in general about Buddhism, and so that's what we're going to talk about now. And the first piece is Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist practice is very inclusive, open, and adaptable. So the tenets and practices are really very open and adaptable and inclusive. And so it takes on flavors as it moves. It started in India, and it moves through Southeast Asia and China to Japan and then to Tibet, and then, of course, around the world. And as it moves, it adapts to the culture in which it finds itself. Okay? In many ways, more than Christianity did, certainly, even more than Islam did. And Islam was pretty adaptable to cultural practices. In a lot of ways, Buddhism is kind of like the English language. You know what they say about English? It chases other languages down dark alleys and mugs them for its pronouns. The same thing is true about Buddhism. It incorporates what it discovers. But the basic root of all Buddhism, the thing that all Buddhism has in common, is that it is based on the life and the teachings of a man called, and I'm going to flummox this, Gautama.
You want to spell it?
Gautana. who lived in India and is called the Buddha. So if you see statues of the Buddha, it's Gautama that those statues are of. Now you'll notice if you look at statues of Buddha that he looks really different in lots of the different statues, and it's like Jesus and Muhammad and Moses. No pictures were made of him in his lifetime. So all of the statues take on the persona of the flavor of Buddhism where the statues are made, just like, you know, a lot of the pictures of Jesus, he looks like he came from Norway.
Yeah.
And,
Where did this guy live?
Well, I'm going to get to that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was going to ask the same question. Perfect, though. He was born in what is now Nepal, probably around 566 BC. All right? He grew up and married and had a son, and I'll tell you a little more about his life story. But so we're talking about kind of the mid-550 years before Jesus. So that's where we are. And we're in Nepal in the Indian subcontinent area. All right. Buddha means, the word Buddha means one who has been awakened or the enlightened one, depending on who's translating for you. So there are actually lots of people who could carry the title Buddha. But when we talk about the Buddha, we're talking about Gautama. All right? But that is not a title that is limited to him. It's not like Christ that refers only to Jesus. Buddha is a title that could refer to any number of people.
How do you spell Buddha?
B-U-D-D-H-A.
Okay. I knew there was an H in there someplace.
Yes. And Buddhism, at least most varieties of it, believe that there are both incarnated, that is human, physically, and celestial Buddhas. So there are enlightened ones who are human, walking around among us. And there are enlightened ones...
There's up at Niagara, or up in Canada, that we can go visit or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's a statue of...
And it's...
Yes.
Yeah. I've been there. Mm-hmm. I've been there. It's very impressive.
In Niagara Falls?
In
Niagara Falls.
No, in Niagara, in Canada. Yeah, but
Canadian
it's in
side.
Yeah. It's not very far over.
There's a Chinese temple in Niagara Falls.
Mm-hmm.
U.S.?
Mm-hmm. No, Canada.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I've been there.
So, any person in Buddhist philosophy has the potential to become a Buddha. Although over time the title has more and more been reserved for Gautama. And as we get further and further away from his life, more and more that title gets reserved for him. But technically any one of us has the potential to become a Buddha. Mm. All right? So, I mentioned that he was born in what is now Nepal around 566 BC. He was a prince of the Sakya tribe, which is S-A-K-Y-A. Like I said, he grew up and married, and he had a son. At the age of 29, he left home, and he started a spiritual quest to understand the suffering that he saw around him. If this sounds like the story of Francis of Assisi, that is because it's very much like the same story. He followed very, very strict spiritual practices for 6 years. And after 6 years of very strict spiritual practices, long hours of meditation, lots of fasting, all of this stuff, he realized that they were not moving him any nearer to enlightenment. So he kind of abandoned a lot of them. And as the story goes, he was meditating alone under a Bodhi tree. Bodhi is B-O-D-H-I. When he reached enlightenment at the age of 35, he spent the next 45 years wandering and preaching in what is today North India. So if you often when you see statues of Buddha, he's depicted under some kind of thing that is, and more stylized these days, but a stylized branch. Mm-hmm. That's him sitting under the tree. All right. All forms of Buddhism have at their center four noble truths and an eightfold path. And this is where we begin. Now, a lot of these will sound familiar to you, but unlike the Judeo-Christian religions, where the kind of sacred numbers are 3, 7, and 40, in Buddhist, the sacred numbers are 4 and 8, and those are the perfect numbers. So, for what that's worth.
Even numbers and odd numbers.
And odd numbers, yes. Well, 40 is an even number, but, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, so the Four Noble Truths are, number one, life is suffering. So that's the starting point, is if you feel like you're suffering, well, then you've correctly discerned life.
You're alive.
Yes. The second noble truth is that there is a reason for this suffering. So you're not just suffering to suffer, there's a reason for the suffering. The third noble truth is that there is a way to end suffering. And the fourth noble truth is that the way to end suffering is the Eightfold Path. So life is suffering, you're suffering for a reason, there's a way to end it, and now we're going to tell you what it is. All right. So the Eightfold Path breaks down into a couple of chunks. Basically, it falls into three categories: wisdom, morality, and concentration. So the Eightfold Path breaks up into three, two in one part and three in the others. Wisdom, morality, and concentration. I'm going to do these in an order, but it's very important to remember that this is not a progression. If you want to follow the Eightfold Paths, you have to do all eight pieces all at the same time. It is not a progression. It's not that you do the first step and get it perfectly, and then you move on to the second step. You have to work on all eight of them simultaneously. All right? And ideally, get as good at all eight at the same time. So if you find yourself getting better at one, you need to turn your attention to the others.
All right. So it's something that you have to do on a daily basis. It's part of your life.
Yes.
Not something that I will separate myself from.
Correct.
I do this.
Yes. You need to integrate it into your life. All right. So the two parts of the Eightfold Path that deal with wisdom. The first is right views, having right views. That is understanding the teachings of Buddha, but also understanding truth and reality. Okay? So you have to have right views. You have to understand the teachings, you have to understand truth, you have to understand the reality of the world around you, and you have to do that correctly.
That's pretty big.
Yes.
That one.
Yeah, that's a big one right there.
How do you discern what is truth?
Well, that's a really good question. And that's a lot of Buddhist theology is about what is truth, what is reality, and how do we tell.
Do they believe it's evidence-based?
Depends on which branch you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Some
also,
yes and some
probably
no.
Probably what truth you're talking about.
Right. And also remember that this is an Eastern religion, and so science has a really different meaning for the ancient Near East. It's not so much have a philosophy or have a hypothesis, prove it or disprove it, and have others replicate it. It's much more things seen and things unseen are much more connected in the Eastern world.
But when you talk about
us.
The word reality, that seems more evidence based. I mean, things you can touch and feel and measure, and
to
more
us,
like the science approach.
But, to us,
okay.
Eastern philosophy says that things unseen are as real as things you can see and touch.
Okay.
So things of the spirit are equally real.
Or relationships.
To, yes.
Hate and
yes,
love and all
yes,
that.
Yes, all okay. of those things.
Okay.
So, like when we talk about Judaism and I say this comes out of a different worldview, this comes out of a different worldview. So, but it's also very open and inclusive. So as it's come to the West, a lot of Buddhists are very much interested in science because it's a way to find right reality. So the answer is yes and no. Which is
judging, which I very few, but it seems to be a very positive and uplifting, and generally speaking, a happy way of life.
Well, the goal is, remember, that we're doing this all to overcome suffering. So the better we get at this, the less suffering we will have. So the second part of the Eightfold Path that fits in with wisdom is right aspiration. So you have right views, you understand the teachings, you have a right view of truth and reality, and you have right aspiration, that is high and noble aims, selfless, in other words, which I just talked about as reading, I'm reading The Following the Way of Jesus. It's about, you know, selflessness. So you're supposed to have high and noble aims, and ideally aims for the world beyond yourself. What most Buddhists would say is that the more you focus on what on getting something for yourself, the more suffering you will have. So,
what do you think the reason for suffering means?
What do I think the reason for suffering is? I can tell you, Christian perspective is different. Buddhists would say that the reason for suffering is that people do not have right views and right aspirations, and that we suffer from the consequences of other people's lack of right views and right aspirations, which is really very similar to the Christian understanding, except that we talk about the evil powers of this world which corrupt and destroy the creatures of God. So we talk about everyone's sin having impact on other people. And so it's kind of a similar understanding, although with Buddhists don't have a sense of a personification of evil. They don't have a sense that there is evil, an evil force behind the evil in the world, that what we perceive as evil comes from people failing to live into their best light. Whereas Christians and Islam and Judaism and even Hinduism have a sense of the evil.
We have a scapegoat called Satan.
Well, yes, but beyond Satan, which is a personification of evil, we have a sense that there is an evil force. Buddhists don't really have a sense that there is an evil force.
But it also sounds like, you know, because in Christianity we have, just by our human condition, we are sinful, I guess. Mm-hmm. Where they're more like saying, by your human condition, you're suffering. It doesn't sound so...
Yes, yes.
Like, down on you kind of thing. You know, you're suffering.
That's so condemning.
Exactly.
Yes. That's exactly right. And actually, one of the things I'll get to is that one of the core Buddhist beliefs is that everyone has a divine spark. So we all have a bit of the divine within us, and that the more that we follow the Eightfold Path, the more that will come out.
So they don't have a concept of an evil force.
Right.
Do they have a divine force?
They do.
A God?
Yes. It is God. It is, although they prefer the word divine spark, or light, or enlightenment. But the sense that, but not in the sense of a God that you can have a relationship with.
Or that you would worship or pray to
right,
or anything
exactly.
like that.
Right, exactly. More of perfect enlightenment. And that you have a piece of that in you, and that the more that you pay attention to it, the bigger it will get. It's less a personal God, and it's certainly not a relationship-based. You're not building a relationship with the divine.
It's your father, son.
Yes,
story.
Yeah. You're nurturing the divine within you, rather than, okay?
You say that life is suffering, mm-hmm. and there's a way to end it. It sounds like, mm-hmm. yes, die.
No, actually. Because, and I'll get to that, but because death doesn't end the life journey.
Reincarnation.
You're reincarnated.
So,
oh, okay.
So
and it could get worse.
Yes.
Yes. Just like the winter could
yes.
be worse.
Yes. The search for enlightenment, they would say, is not limited to one lifetime. And I'll talk about that more when we get there, but I want to get back to the Eightfold Path. So we have the first two, right views and right aspirations. And those are the two that comprise the wisdom section. Then we move on to the morality section. This is how you live. And again, move on is a slightly different, wrong way to say this. But while you're working on your right views and right aspirations and your wisdom, now you get to work on your morality. The first piece under morality is right speech, which is everyone you speak, you should speak kindly, not gossiping, not lying, not backbiting, not being sarcastic, which is why I could never be a Buddhist. So that's the first step of, or well, that's the first under the morality, is that you speak correctly. And the reason for that is you're nurturing the divine spark within you, what comes out of your mouth. And, you know, Jesus said, it's not what goes into your mouth that defiles you is what comes out of your mouth that defiles you. Mm-hmm. They would say the same thing, and also that you put into the universe right speech. The next one is right conduct. And the way you know it's right conduct, basically, and these are very, this is very basic surface level, but the way you know it's right conduct is if it's compassionate. So you are to behave compassionately. And again, because less because it does good for the people that you're helping and more because it makes you nurture that divine spark within you, but right conduct. And then the last piece under morality is right livelihood. Honest work that does not cause suffering to others. So you need to look at how you make your money and how you spend your money, and you are to do that honestly and in a way that does not cause suffering to others. So a lot of Buddhists will not serve in the army or in the military because that causes suffering to others. There's a lot of debate in Buddhist circles about whether you can be in finance mm-hmm. and be following
the Eightfold
Path.
That was true with Judaism, mm-hmm. too.
Mm-hmm. And it's actually a reason that you will find a lot of Buddhists in the sciences, because
researchers
looking for truth, not causing suffering to others. And if there is one area that Buddhist thinkers debate more than any other, it is what does right livelihood mean, and how do you discern? So those are the three around morality. Right speech, right conduct, right livelihood. All right.
Is there a written place anywhere, like tablets? The Ten Commandments? This is right, or is it a feeling that you get when you...
Yeah. While there are monks, and you've heard of the Dalai Lama, and leaders of different kinds, there is no, in Buddhism, teaching authority. People follow monks or priests or teachers because they seem to them to have more wisdom, but there's nobody who really can say, I am the leader. Now, the Dalai Lama is the selected leader of Tibetan Buddhism, but Nepal Buddhism sects don't, I mean, it's kind of like we feel about the Pope. It's like, oh yeah, he's the head of their branch of it, but he doesn't get to tell us what to do.
Did Buddha write anything?
Yes. And that's called the Dharma, are the teachings of Buddha. But like the teachings of Jesus, they were a lot more oral, written down by others, or written down by others later than... Like Jesus, he was a roving teacher. And so there are a lot of the sayings of Buddha, but nothing, we don't have a document that Buddha wrote himself.
Same as Jesus.
This is, as we do this, it's going to be like, oh yeah, that sounds familiar to me.
That's interesting, because these things arose in such different places with no communication, yet there's... divine.
And so they have teachers. Do they have places of akin to our worship?
They have temples. Okay. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. But the temple is a place where you will find, in most branches of Buddhism, I will continue to caveat, monks, who are people who are devoting their whole lives to the Eightfold Path. And so if you seek instruction, the feeling is you go to the people who are really... spending their whole life on it. They don't have worship services in the way that we do. There's not like a time that you go to worship. There are communities and community activities, but it's not like Christian Judaism, Islam, where there is a holy day and you go to worship God. It sounds
like a more self-centered thing that
you're always working on yourself. Yes. Mm-hmm. So we've got the two parts of the Eightfold Path that are about wisdom and the three parts that are about morality. The last three parts are about concentration. And again, because we're working on nurturing the divine spark within us, right effort is the next piece. And so you're working on putting your effort into the right things, okay? Right mindfulness. And this is the part of Buddhism that has become really big lately, is mindfulness. That is being aware of not only where you are and what's going on around you, but of the impact your actions are having and where there are, just being aware of the world around you and what you're doing and why you're doing it and what effect it's having on you and on others. So mindfulness and doing that. And then right meditation. And this is the core Buddhist practice, is connecting as much as you can with the divine spark inside you and letting everything else go, right? And if you've ever tried, and every religion has meditation practices, if you've ever tried meditation, it is not easy. It's certainly not easy for me. I've got a real monkey mind, but some people do it better than others. And what the Buddhists would say is that the goal of meditation is not to connect with the divine outside of yourself, but to connect with the divine inside of yourself. And for a lot of, in a lot of Buddhist sects, the way you become a monk, the way you advance in the religious life, is more time in meditation. I forget now which branch it is, but one of the branches, the test for becoming a monk is 40 days meditation.
Yes, I heard that.
So...
Yes.
Not going to be my life. But, but again, the goal is to connect to the divine spark within you. And they really believe that can ultimately only be done in silence. That can't be done. But again, while you're doing right meditation and right mindfulness, you also have to be doing right conduct and right livelihood and right aspirations and right speech. So it's not that, okay, I've got the right livelihood down, now I move to right meditation. All of these things feed each other, right? So you bring out of your meditation, goes back to your aspirations, which impacts your conduct, which impacts your mindfulness, so that these all connect and you're working on them all at the same time. All right, I'll stop there for a minute.
What was the first one? Right?
Right views.
That was the first one under wisdom.
Mm-hmm. No.
The first one under concentration, right effort.
Thank you.
And you notice they all are right.
Right.
No.
Correct.
You do it yes. You do it correctly. Correct effort, correct mindfulness, correct meditation. You do it in the right way.
So if there are no written commands, mm-hmm. as we're accustomed mm-hmm. to, the knowledge of what is right, how does... So is that sort of individual also?
It's both individual and community, and where the balance is between the individual judging the right and the community having input to what is right depends on which branch you're talking about. Mm-hmm. They all have some combination of you discern it for yourself in connecting with divine spark, and you are instructed by those who are further along the path than you are.
And also, I would think from mm-hmm. what you said that an important thing is don't cause suffering to others.
Right.
And that would, if right. you do that, that's being wrong.
That's right. It almost sounds like it comes from within, and that mm-hmm. some, in there we know what's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It
really does all come back down to everyone has a divine spark within you. And the more you are connected to your divine spark, the more you
the
will
more
know,
you'll know
what's right. Okay. Now, you've all probably heard of the word karma, and it gets misused in modern Western thinking, you know, well, if I do something bad, then, you know, well, I cut somebody off in traffic, so now I can't find a parking space. This is not actually...
It's not. It's
kind of a... Although it is kind of the law of cause and effect, but it's... It's much more that if you put evil out into the world, you will dim your divine spark. And so it will rebound on you as more suffering. And if you put good out into the world, it will enhance your divine spark and rebound to you as less suffering. So it's not that there's a one-on-one cause and effect between do good and good will be done to you, as Jesus said, but it's... What you put out into the world will impact the divine within you, and the dimmer your divine spark is, the more suffering you will have, and the brighter your divine spark is, the less suffering you will have.
How do you spell karma?
K-R-M-A.
Does that lead to, you think of suffering if someone's ill. Mm-hmm. Now, does that lead a person to think, I must have done something wrong, or I'm not getting in touch, and I'm wondering mm-hmm. where that fits in a real life.
Sure, and yes, or and that is also very human. A lot of Christians do that. You know, the right. number of Christians who say, and we're actually going to hear it on Sunday, that, you know, Jesus is talking about, if you listen to the gospel reading, Jesus is talking about those on whom the Tower of Salome fell, you know, who sinned? You know, who sinned? And Jesus said, well, nobody sinned. Bad things just happen. But a lot of Christians are the, well, if I were living a better life, bad things wouldn't happen to me. Or good things are happening to me, I must be living right.
Well, you heard that on the news. If someone's house gets hit by a tornado,
right.
it's like, you know what?
Yes.
Or if they don't, if they escape, right. it's, oh, God was watching
God over was
me.
Watching over me.
So and the converse of that is...
Right.
You think.
Yes,
yeah.
the guy yeah. that got mm-hmm. hit by the tornado,
right.
God wasn't watching.
Right,
why?
Exactly. Why? Mm-hmm. And so that's common to all religions, mm-hmm. that kind of heresy of...
Is that common to religion or common to humanity?
I think it's common to humanity.
Because it seems to show up everywhere.
It does.
Like mm-hmm. in the Old Testament, women that were ancient mm-hmm. women mm-hmm. without children
right.
were cursed
right.
because
right.
God hadn't blessed them.
Right, exactly. Okay. Exactly. Where was I going with that? Oh, and so, you know, in Christians you hear that, well, if you just pray right, God
right.
will heal you. And, you know, as I fight constantly against the God is not a candy machine. You know, you don't put in your dime and mm-hmm. forget which one, although you can't get anything for a dime anymore. But
the kind of thing that is based on knowledge. When you don't have any knowledge about that you invented, and then later on you learn the cause of this or that or the other thing. Oh, it wasn't God; it was a bacteria. You know.
Yes, and. So there is all of that. So that's the basic sense of karma, is that what you put into the world impacts the divine spark within you. Now, some forms of Buddhism include reincarnation in their belief system, which is your divine spark moves from lifetime to lifetime. And so if you have dimmed your divine spark in this life, you will come back and be... Basically, you have to work on your divine spark until you reach enlightenment. And if you're able to do it in this life, great. And then you would become a celestial Buddha. And if you are not, then you will come back and work on it again.
Can you come back as an animal?
Most Buddhists would say no.
So it's the Hindus
that... It's the Hindus that believe in other kinds of reincarnation.
So eventually there's a life everlasting.
Eventually your divine spark rejoins with all the other divine sparks that have reached enlightenment. They don't have a sense of the individual personality living forever, but the divine spark within you, when you reach enlightenment, it will rejoin with all of the other divine sparks that have reached enlightenment. And will not be incarnated again. Not all of the Buddhist branches have reincarnation at their base. What the ones who don't say is that at death, your divine spark rejoins with all the other divine sparks, and if you're a dim one, you just bring your dimness into the light. You don't want to do that. You don't want to be the dimmest light in the...
You want to be that light.
Yeah, exactly.
The divine spark is the thing that survives.
Yes.
After
Yes, we would call it the soul, but soul in particularly Western Christian parlance has a sense of our personality with it, and really Buddhism has no sense of the survival of the personality beyond death. So it's not kind of the individual, it's,
So it's interesting because it's very individual. It's very internal, and then the goal is very not necessary.
Right. Yeah. Yes, it's actually true. It's very self-centered in that you're supposed to be working on your divine spark, except that the eventual goal of the path is for you to be egoless. So to put yourself completely aside for others. So it's a little bit counterintuitive in that you focus internally so as to remove yourself.
Become selfless.
And become selfless.
It's kind of like meditation.
Yes.
Meditation is such a big part of Buddhism.
Yes. Yes.
It's kind of like what Michael Curry was saying, one of those chapters where he said he believed that the opposite of love is not hate, but it's selfishness.
Selfishness,
and
that's right.
Love is giving and caring more about others.
That's right.
He's right about that.
That's right. The opposite, and that's what the Presiding Bishop says in his book, is the opposite of love is not hate, it's selfishness. I usually say indifference, because I think that's a little... I get my head around it a little bit that way, better that way. But the opposite. But if you hate somebody, you have interest in them. You're connected to them. And so the opposite of loving someone isn't still being connected to them. It's disconnecting yourself from them. So, and Buddhists would say that too. That the opposite of following the right path, one of the ways to follow the wrong path is to focus only on yourself and not care about your impact on others. Okay? I talked about Dharma, which is the teachings of the Buddha. Buddhism in America tends to be of three types, and it's these three types because they are popular with the white community. Now, this is beginning to change as our immigration patterns changed and we got people moving in from the East who were genuinely Buddhists of their own. But there were three types of Buddhism that got picked up by kind of white Americans. And so most of the people who say that they practice Buddhism in the United States fall into these three types. Zen Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, and Vipassana.
How do you spell it?
V-I-P-A-S-S-A-N-A. And don't ask me too much about the difference between them, because I can't really tell you that much, but they are three different flavors of Buddhism. And as I said, the Dalai Lama is connected with Tibetan Buddhism. And then there's a very radical sect of Buddhism that even the Buddhists say is probably heretical. And it's really hard to get Buddhists to say that anything is heretical because they just don't operate that way. but this is called Shin Buddhism. Shin is S-H-I-N. And Shin Buddhism focuses only on faith, not on any practices. And so
the Baptists of Buddhism.
They're kind of the Baptists of Buddhism. you're saved through faith alone, not through anything that you do. And the other Buddhists would say, you've only got one of the Eightfold Path. You've only got the right views. And you can't do that. That you're not correctly nurturing your divine spark without all the others. You only have one part of the Eightfold Path. If you follow international news at all, you may have read about Buddhist terrorism,
yes.
Which makes everybody go, huh?
Yes, exactly.
It seems like an oxymoron. That's where that comes from, is from Shin Buddhism, which says, you must believe correctly. All of this practice stuff is...
Where has that taken place, that terrorism?
Mostly in India and Nepal.
Oh.
But
that Thailand area, isn't
yes,
it? Where the Buddhists
yes.
and the Muslims
yes,
are.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And also some in Indonesia.
Yeah, I was going to say Indonesia.
When I say that, the moderates of the Abrahamic faith need to bind together because we have much more in common than the radicals in our own communities. The same thing is true in the Buddhist community. As you've heard, we have a lot in common with kind of the worldview of Buddhists, except for the radicals. And so every religion has this problem, that there are radical elements that take the teachings and corrupt them. And if you had told me when I first started going to seminary that there would be Buddhist terrorists, I would have said, no. No, you can't. It is not possible to follow the Eightfold Path and be a terrorist because you're supposed to, kind of one of the first things you're supposed to do is have right aspirations and not cause suffering to others. And if you're not doing at least those two basic things, and then I learned about Shin Buddhism and Buddhists were like, oh yeah, those crazy people over there. I'm like, oh yeah, we have those too.
Is that related in any way to Shintoism?
A little bit. Shintoism, and it is kind of where it comes from. Shinto were Buddhists, but also warriors, which is also a little bit of a contradiction in terms. But there's about 1,000 years difference between the end of the Shintos and the Shin Buddhism we have today. So they picked up a lot of it but more in the, oh, we're after them.
I read someplace that the Buddhists don't believe in God. And the reason I say that is because I'm wondering if the divine spark, you could have a divine spark without God.
Yes, and it depends on which flavor of Buddhism you're talking about. Some flavors of Buddhism would say there is no such thing as a divine outside yourself. There is only the divine spark within yourself. Yeah. Other flavors of Buddhism say that the divine spark within yourself is a piece of the eternal divine. What all Buddhists have in common is that they would say there is no such thing as a personal God. There's not a God you can have a relationship with. Whether that translates to there is no God, or...
Probably depends on the Western mind that's translating it.
Some depends on which branch of Buddhism you're talking about. Zen Buddhism would say there really is no divine outside of the divine spark within you. Tibetan Buddhism would say that there is a divine, and that the spark within you is a piece of the overarching divine.
What would they say about creation, or
how the world came to be?
Yeah.
Buddhists don't generally have a creation narrative as a part of their religion. It's just not of interest to them. The world is what it is, and you live in it. And how it came to be is not a matter of theology. I could probably dig up some Buddhist writings about creation, but it's not something they write about a lot. They just aren't interested in it.
There's a statue in mm-hmm. Buffalo down mm-hmm. by the Broadway Market. It's mm-hmm. a Vietnamese Buddhist mm-hmm. erected it. It's a woman. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the Japanese, and I think Thai also, mm-hmm. they revere certain figures. Mm-hmm. So if you go to the temples, they're very confusing. Mm-hmm. It's not like our altar where there's mm-hmm. no, right. or there might be mm-hmm. Jesus, but... Mm-hmm. In the temples there are many, many different creatures and many different mm-hmm. things. And I did not know what mm-hmm. what they all meant.
Well, and they might not know what they all mean.
They might not know.
The thing about Buddhist temples is anything in the temple is there because it's an aid to someone's Eightfold Path. So there's lots of different statues of Buddha sometimes, and sometimes there are... statues of ancestors or of people who were particularly enlightened, who were good teachers, and people leave offerings of different things in front of the statues.
There are also like women that they revere.
Yes.
That, mm-hmm. I can't think of any of the names right now. Dennis would know that.
Yeah.
But that's what the statue in Buffalo is. Mm-hmm. It's a woman that the mm-hmm. Vietnamese Buddhist mm-hmm. revere.
Yes.
My granddaughter's in Vietnam right now mm-hmm. studying for the semester.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And that was one of the things that she said when she was home for a couple weeks, was that it was very confusing because the major religion mm-hmm. in Vietnam is Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And yet all the temples are everywhere,
mm-hmm.
and they're Buddhist.
Right.
And they seem to mesh.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And she said it's just very confusing that mm-hmm. Buddhists and Christians just kind of are together.
In some Buddhist temples, you will even find statues of Jesus or the Virgin Mary.
Yes.
Because they help a particular member of the community that worships at that temple focus on some part of the Eightfold Path.
I gave her the book when she went back, Living Buddha, Living Christ.
Mm-hmm.
I said, maybe this will kind of mm-hmm. help you mm-hmm. just kind of get a sense mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. where they're coming mm-hmm. from.
And actually, from the Buddhist perspective, we're doing it wrong, but we're moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
Right? We have the wrong kind of focus, but we're on the Eightfold Path. We're working on, eventually we'll get our right views there. We're a little weak on that part. But Jesus helped people along the Eightfold Path, the Buddhists would say. Christians have been a lot less, over history certainly, a lot less open and adaptable to the Buddhists than the Buddhists have been to the Christians. Yeah. And part of that is because in Christianity, orthodoxy, right belief, is paramount. In Buddhism, orthopraxy, right practice, is paramount. Okay? And those two things don't generally peacefully coexist forever. You know, that if the most important thing in your faith is right believing, and the most important thing in my faith is right practice or right living, eventually we're going to come into conflict, because ultimately, I don't care what you believe, I just care what you do. Ultimately, you don't care what I do, you just care what I believe.
But that's not true in Christianity. I mean, right? I mean,
actually,
faith without works is dead.
Faith without works is dead,
you
but...
To live
which
your
branch
faith.
You're talking about.
Again, it depends on which branch of Christianity you're talking about, but ultimately, in its base, Christianity is about believing that Jesus is the Son of God. Mm-hmm. And the right practice, the works, flow from the belief. Mm-hmm. Buddhism would say, if you have to pick a part of the Eightfold Path, pick the morality, and the rest will flow from that. Live it, they would say live it and you'll believe it. Christians would say believe it and you'll live it. And while those two things are often able to walk side by side, when you come down to brass tacks, they ultimately are incompatible. So you will hear about people who are both Christians and Buddhists. And a lot of Christians take their Christian faith to Buddhist practice, because they find in the Buddhist practice something that undergirds their Christian faith.
Morality is such a hard thing, though. That's mm-hmm. so dependent upon mm-hmm. the person who is talking about it, and your circumstances of living and mm-hmm. where you are and mm-hmm.
culture.
What about we're supposed to bring more people to the church. Mm-hmm. What about trying to convert people? Is that part of Buddhism?
No, Buddhism is not. So, yeah, okay. Buddhism is not an evangelical religion. They are not at all concerned that, except for the Shins, they are not at all concerned that more people become Buddhist. They're perfectly happy for you to move along your life with your divine spark, and if you don't get it right this time, either you'll take your dim spark into the pool, or you'll be back to try again. They don't see it as in any way, shape, or form their business to convert you to their way of thinking. Now, if you ask for help, they will see it as part of their responsibility to guide you in your spiritual life, but only if you ask for it. There is no such thing as Buddhist door knockers. Nobody knocks on the door and says, I want to tell you about Buddha.
They believe in peace.
Yes. So, again, other than the Shins, who are very concerned that, and again, because in their theology, belief is the only thing that matters. If you believe wrong, you need to be converted. So they very much are Baptist Buddhists. but most Buddhists, oh, that's nice. Yeah. And they'll even come to church with you if you invite them, because they might get a bit of enlightenment from it.
They'll be very peaceful, non-judgmental. Mm-hmm.
That's the goal. Now, again, you're talking about human beings, so everybody lives into this differently and at different levels. But if you're living into Buddhism, your main goal is not to cause suffering to others. That's really how you define whether you're doing anything right. Is are you setting yourself aside? Are you moving towards egolessness? And are you not causing suffering to others? So as we say, love God, love neighbor, on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets, if you pushed a Buddhist to the wall and made him tell you what the two tenets were that were most important, they would say, get your ego out of the way and don't harm others. And from those two things, all of the rest of it will.
What about growth? You know, they say the Islamic world is growing greatly.
The number of people who self-identify as Buddhists, particularly in the West, is growing, but it's really hard to tell because Buddhists don't keep membership rolls. It's not like,
if you're egoless, how would you?
Yeah, there's not a church you join.
Right, there's no parish.
There's no parish.
You can go to any temple.
You can go to any temple or no temple. You can completely follow the Buddhist path without ever setting foot.
Are there any temples
inside
in
a temple?
Buffalo?
There are. I don't remember exactly where, but there are.
Is that Vietnamese one? A temple?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's right by the Broadway Market.
Yeah. So when you go to buy your butter lamb.
We're coming up on Easter.
Yeah. We found it accidentally. We were just going down one way street and going back to the other street, and we saw it.
Yeah.
Any other religion in the world that for whom caring for other people is not the primary things?
Yep.
Who would not care?
Hinduism. Charity or caring for others is not a primary center of that. And we'll talk about that next week. Several of the ancestor cults that were a part of both Africa and Asia did not have caring for others as a primary thing. A lot of the religions around Judaism in the pre-Christian times did not have caring for others as a piece of their...
Are you talking about
supporting
the
poor or whatever?
Probably not, because there's so many of them, and
like it's... animistic?
Yes, and it's really hard to find out much about them, because they don't write anything down, and they don't really share, and you have to be born into them.
Yeah, they're tribal.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot are tribal, so they are a million tribes.
Right, and they're all different.
Yeah.
And they all vary, so probably not, because there's really no way to...
But that's an interesting way.
It is an interesting way, yes. So.
What countries did you mention earlier have the majority of the Buddhist people?
Tibet has a majority Buddhist. Nepal has a majority Buddhist. Japan, it's hard to tell because, again, and it's really hard to tell because people don't write themselves down as...
And the Japanese say, they say about the Japanese, Japanese people are not religious.
Right.
But they all go to temples, they all go to the Zen gardens to meditate.
Right.
So it's not really a religion for them.
It's being Japanese.
Life. It's a meditative aspect. Yeah. But that's what they all say.
Yeah, they all say.
And that's what the majority of Japanese people would say is what you're
saying. Yeah, because one Japanese person always speaks for every Japanese person. Mm-hmm. I would say, except for now, the younger ones are different, definitely different, more Western.
Yes, yeah. And so Buddhism is so much a part of being Japanese that they don't think of it as a religion. They just, we're not religious. We're just going to go meditate now.
Yeah.
You know?
We do. Yeah.
South Korea is another one that meditation is so much a part of being Korean that they
It's very Christian.
It is also very Christian, but even the Christians meditate in the Buddhist temples. Again, it's hard to say because it's not like there's a head count, right?
Buddhism seems to be more a way of life practice, and then your religion seems to be kind of the outline you follow.
Yeah. Thailand and Cambodia, those all would have huge percentage of the population that practice Buddhism. Whether they would say they were Buddhist is a whole different thing.
They They go to the temples like right. on special occasions
right.
to honor their ancestors,
right.
at least in some of the countries.
Right.
And there are zillions of temples everywhere.
Right. So. And there actually are what we would call Christmas and Easter Buddhists.
That's you know, when they go to
the temple on the holidays
on
to honor,
special holidays.
Right.
Yes.
But they don't actually practice much in their daily life. So just as there are Christians who I'll see at Easter and.
But they also have, they're not temples, but they have similar things in their
homes. Yes.
Just mm-hmm. like if you had an, what yeah. do you call it, an altar in
an
your
altar
home.
Or, yeah. Or,
yeah, they. Yeah. I went to a Vietnamese wedding once. First, we had to go to the mother's house, the mother of the bride house, and worship at this place. Then we went to the ceremony, which was hours and hours. Then we went to the father of the groom's house, and there was another setup.
You said the ceremony was hours and hours?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The whole thing was in the middle of the day. They said, now, because we were Christian, they said, now you have to go home and rest and come back for the dinner.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to be clear. A lot of the practices that people who would call themselves Buddhist practice are cultural. So it's not necessarily Buddhist to do this thing, but it is part of the culture of someone who's Vietnamese or someone who's Cambodian
yeah,
or someone who's Thai.
Yeah, it's very different, I would say, in the different countries.
So like I said, remember what I said about Buddhism? It chases, you know, other religions and other cultures down the dark alley and mugs them for its practices. Buddhism is very adaptive of cultural practices. So a Vietnamese Buddhist has a lot of Vietnamese cultural practices that a Tibetan Buddhist
would be different
mm-hmm. and an Indonesian Buddhist it would be different, and an African Buddhist it would be different, because the cultural practices, as long as they don't cause suffering to others, are neither here nor there, and they may help you down the right path. So the ancestor worship that was a part of Eastern culture got sucked up into Buddhism, but it's not, ancestor worship isn't Buddhist, but it's not in conflict with Buddhism. So it got sucked up into...
So it doesn't hurt anybody, so...
It doesn't hurt anybody, and maybe, you know, remembering your ancestors will take you on the path of enlightenment.
Like the spark. Mm-hmm.
So go for it,
keep
you know.
Connected with
right,
the path.
That's right, yes.
I'm so reading that. Visit where the ancestors were buried, when they got married, when there was a birth, and if you knew that life was... the end of life is imminent, then you would also go.
Mm-hmm. And you notice I haven't talked about Buddhist holidays, and that's because there aren't specific holidays that every branch of Buddha celebrates, except for one. There is one that falls, well, it's a lunar calendar, so it's not, it moves. Sometime between the end of November and the beginning of January, there is the celebration of Buddha's enlightenment, when he had his vision under the Dodai tree. All Buddhists celebrate that, and they celebrate it with a feast, but also with reading the Dharma. So it's, you reconnect yourself to the teaching of the Buddha, and it happens at that November-January time frame when all the holidays seem to happen. So,
the night before enlightenment.
That's right. all right. So there's your overview of Buddhism. Next week we'll do an overview of Hinduism and see where we go from there. All right?
Very good. Thank you.